from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show.
This will be an everlasting love. This will be the one I've waited for. This will be the first time anyone has loved me.
And now, your host, so Gary Knoll.
He found me in time, and I'm so glad that to find my mind.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Today, well, an original, in-depth investigative report, number 18, if you're counting, Wikipedia supporting the dark side of medicine, ? This is a report fully documented, fully footnoted, fully legally vetted by Helen Beniski and myself. Also today, we will have a guest in the second part of our program, Professor Dan Kovalik. He is going to talk about American interventionism, how the United States interferes in the outcome of elections and promotes regime change around the world, and where is the American media, except acting more like lapdogs to support the overthrow of the Maduro regime in Venezuela. But he was elected. Yeah, he was. And we don't like him. So the media doesn't like him. The media is not supposed to be there to choose who we like and don't like. They're supposed to report honestly, fairly, and accurately. Well, forget that. That's not happening. He is a human rights and labor justice attorney, peace activist, and a professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. His focus is Latin America. And he also worked against Coca-Cola, Drummond Company, Occidental Petroleum, over human rights abuses in Colombia. So he's an interesting person, and we'll talk with him at length. And I'm not going to have a chance to go to a lot of the other commentaries I wanted to, because this is going to take a little bit of time. Normally, I would start our program with the latest on health and healing, and I just want to give you some of the latest studies. This is from King's College London, published in the Journal of Gerontology, and it found that eating 200 grams, that's about 6 ounces, not much, a cup, of blueberries every day for a month can lead to an improvement in blood vessel function and a decrease in systolic blood pressure in healthy people. So, the blue in blueberries can help lower blood pressure. And they studied people, and this is what they came to. So, want better blood pressure? Better blood vessel function after just 2 hours of consuming blueberries, then not difficult to do. So we all want healthy blood pressure. And why? Why does it work? Because of the antho, A-N-T-H-O, cyanidins, C-Y-A-N-I-N-S, that led to improvements in endothelial function. And the endo, E-N-D-O, thelial, T-H-E-L-I-A-L, endothelial cells act as a barrier between the blood or lymph and the surrounding body tissue. In effect, they're the lining of your blood vessels. And they play a key role in blood clotting and regulating blood pressure. So that's important. Also, peer support. Healing hands can actually curb prescription opiate misuse. This is from the University of California, San Francisco, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of General Internal Medicine. They took a look at what happens when you're around supportive people and when you're getting supportive therapy, including acupuncture, mindfulness, massage, gentle exercises can help prevent patients on prescription opiates from spiraling down to drug misuse and overdose and death. When you consider how many people are dying from these every year, this is really important because opiates are often prescribed to patients with moderate to severe pain from chronic health conditions or after surgery, and then people get hooked on them, and they don't really do a whole lot of good anyhow. They've been oversold. But prescriptions, opiates from your doctor, are more lethal than heroin. That's correct. The most notable improvement was a 22% boost in pain self-efficacy and a patient's able to manage and function in their daily life despite their pain. And again, why? Because of therapeutic touch, and also because of meditation, mindfulness. And this was a 3-month program, and it worked. So we could be helping save lives, because when you consider how many people died from overdosing on drugs involving prescription opiates, it was 17,029 just in 2017, according to the CDC. But remember, a lot of drug deaths are not properly attributable to the drug. So if a person takes a drug and overdies because of a heart attack, more often than not, the heart attack will be considered the cause of death, not the opiates. So look at the natural non-toxic way of dealing with this. Also from Dalian Medical University in China, published in the Journal of Clinical Investigations, how stress affects cancer growth, it does. But how vitamin C can suppress it, it also does. So, here's the takeaway message. Chronic stress increases cancer's growth. It's known as stress-induced cancer, and it can be reversed with vitamin C. That's really powerful. It's important. So, breast cancer stem cells can be resistant to treatment and may hinder eradication of the disease. And according to the study, you can kill all the cells you want in a tumor. But if the stem cells, it's the mother cells, are not killed, then the tumor is going to grow and metastasize. So in the current study, immunodeficient mice that were exposed to stressful conditions for 1 week ended up with the cancer growing, but then vitamin C was introduced and it helped block it. It suppressed lactate dehydrogenase, an enzyme that is increased by epinephrine, and so it made a difference. So the takeaway message is start taking a lot of vitamin C on a daily basis up to bowel tolerance throughout the day. Best to take it in a protein shake, even a banana with some liquid, and then put your vitamin C, because that buffers it so you'll get more into your system without hitting gastric distress and ending up with diarrhea. And also, keeping active in middle age is now shown to lower your risk of dementia as you age. And this is from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology. Here's the bottom line. The more exercise you do when you're in your 30s and 40s and 50s, and the more mentally active you are at that time, you're going to have a lower risk of developing dementia decades later. That's important. And we want to see that people live a longer life. And also the potential link between vitamin D deficiency and the loss of brain plasticity. University of Queensland, which is in Australia, you need vitamin D for your brain health. And when you're deficient, you can end up with a greater likelihood of having depression. So, we have over 1 billion people in this world who are deficient in vitamin D, minimally. And that deficiency can impair cognition. And unfortunately, exactly how vitamin D influences brain structure and function is not well understood. But we know that it's important because it affects what is known as scaffolding in the brain. And it's called a paraneural nets. And these nets form a strong supportive mesh around certain neurons, brain cells. And in doing so, they stabilize the contacts these cells make with other neurons. And vitamin D is important for that whole process. So get your vitamin D and have a better brain. Also from the Salk Institute, scientists identified a healing compound in Herba Santa that is good for Alzheimer's. So just think for a moment. For those people who say, well, nature doesn't provide anything, well, aspirin comes from white willow bark. And digitalis for people who have angina. And the anti-malarial artemisium all come from plants. So the Salk Institute discovered a potent neuroprotective and anti-inflammatory chemical in the a native California shrub that might lead to a treatment for Alzheimer's disease. It's based upon a compound found in nature. And the research appears in the current issue of the journal Redox Biology. So that's good. And so they were using it to reverse neurological disease symptoms. And they studied over 400 different plant extracts, known pharmacological properties. And they found that those that have the flavonoids from plants that have anti-inflammatory and neuroprotective properties work best. And through the screen, the lab identified a molecule called sterubin, S-T-E-R-U-B-I-N, as Herbasanta's most active component. And the researchers tested sterubin and other plant extracts for their impact on energy depletion in nerve cells and other age-associated neurotoxicity and survival pathways directly related to reduced energy and metabolism and accumulation of what are called misfolded or aggregated proteins in inflamed areas of the brain in Alzheimer's. And they showed strong, potent anti-inflammatory impacts on brain cells known as microglia. This is all good. So a simple plant and a flavonoids from the plant can impact on Alzheimer's. And that's terrific. So that's the latest on health and healing. And I'll be back in a moment and give you an in-depth original investigative report, which is published also on prn.fm, where we are challenging the individuals who are the so-called experts at Wikipedia. And we are challenging them and would like the rest of the American media to come on board and take a look for yourself. Is this really an objective, fair, open encyclopedia? Or has it been used to vilify, destroy, denigrate, slander, and libel people with no opportunity for recourse, even by its own rules? And we are presenting our evidence. Our evidence has been created so that it will withstand cross-examination, an expert rebuttal, in a court of law. That should give you something to think about. Number 18 in the series, and we have over 100 planned. Wikipedia supporting the dark side of medicine, ? In a moment. Despite what doctors may tell their patients, medicine is not infallible. Bad treatments and dangerous drugs have persisted as universally accepted medical practice for long periods of time, far beyond when people began to catch on to their dark side. During the 20th century, we willingly subjected ourselves to lobotomies, electroshock therapy, mercury amalgam fillings, thalidomide, tapeworm egg diet pills, water fluoridation, heroin cough syrup, and insulin comas. Even in the still young 21st century, the list of discredited drugs and treatments is long. Vioxx, with a minimum of 55,000 dead of heart attacks and strokes before it was pulled in the largest drug recall in history. Zyprexa, which causes diabetes and massive weight gain and other forms of metabolic syndrome. Neurontin, which causes psychosis and suicide in patients with no pre-existing mental issues. The SSRIs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which cause the suicides they're supposed to prevent. Fosamax and other osteoporosis drugs, which cause the bone loss they're supposed to prevent. Statins, which increase the risk of cancer and diabetes and neurodegenerative disorders. mammograms, which spread the cancer they're supposed to detect. It was not science, nor the medical profession, that caused these once popular treatments to fall out of favor, to be discredited and ultimately withdrawn from the marketplace. Nor was it any federal agencies charged with protecting the public health. No, it was not the FDA, nor the CDC, nor the National Cancer Institute or National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease or National Anti-Aging Institute. No. More often than not, it was whistleblowers, investigative journalists, citizen activists, and the victims who had been damaged by these treatments who had no advocates in the medical-industrial complex or the government or the media. The vast majority of these treatments, all of which were considered beyond reproach at one time, should never have seen the light of day. Nothing has changed since the last crop of dangerous drugs was approved. If anything, there are even fewer patient protections in place, with pharmaceutical companies proffering to wait until a drug is already on the market to monitor post-marketing patients for adverse effects, instead of corporate integrity providing a very high standard of accountability that the drugs they are producing are safe and effective against actual placebos. We have the halls of government overflowing with a colonized legion of lobbyists, scientists, physicians for hire, all there at the behest of big corporate interests protecting the proprietary profit stream. We see attractive young people with great personalities, good looks, and impeccable grooming, hired by the thousands by Big Pharma to get their drugs into doctors' offices. All the more reason, then, to question the medical status quo. Big Pharma and its unsavory control over our entire government regulatory apparatus have packed the immunization schedules with more vaccines than ever, despite terrible evidence to support their safety and efficacy. The average child is on multiple medications, and so are their parents. We're the most over-medicated nation in the world. Even the New England Journal of Medicine's former editor, Marcia Angel, has said in no uncertain terms that these drugs are not being promoted based upon real science and efficacy, but rather on profit and market share. We have more people who are sick and dying of preventable diseases than ever before in American history. And it's a $3.4 trillion a year business. The most profitable single industry on the planet is America's medicine. And while we acknowledge the exemplary quality of emergency medicine, yes, it works, it saves lives, we're also equally concerned about the dismal failure of chronic care in treating common conditions like diabetes and arthritis and cancer and heart disease. Once again, we ask, who's looking after the well-being and safety of the people? It is not the members of the medical-industrial complex. It is not your physicians or nurses. It is not the hospitals. It is not the media, who are funded by pharmaceutical advertising. It is not our federal agencies, which are fully captured by these companies. It is not the think tanks or other foundations and Astro Group-funded groups with enormous profit from the industry. Even the consumer advocates and whistleblowers of the late 20th century, Ralph Nader's and the Jeffrey Wiggins, have largely fallen silent, grown old, or died, or have been deemed persona non grata by the media, and especially the liberal media, with the next generation having failed to follow through on what they had created. Some people believe the responsibility for looking out for the little guy falls with Jimmy Wales and the self-selected group of experts who guard Wikipedia's medical entries, deciding which are safe and effective medical treatments and procedures, which should be approached with caution and which should be rejected altogether. But then we begin to look into the background of Wales and his small band of skeptics, the gatekeepers of all information involving health and medicine, alternative healing, and modalities on Wikipedia. Our years-long investigation has shown clearly and unequivocally that the Library of Medicine the government's official site for high-quality peer-reviewed articles, and the National Academy of Sciences. Virtually all major academic institutions that do research, such as Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Columbia and Brown, and tens of thousands of scientists and physicians doing original, high-quality research in publishing and peer-reviewed clinical study journals, all of these have shown compelling, positive, and encouraging results for natural treatments. Nutrients as fundamental as vitamin C and vitamin E, magnesium and potassium and resveratrol and curcumin. Acupuncture, herbs such as those used in traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda, and chiropractic. Challenging this robust group of dedicated scientists and physicians and researchers is Jimmy Wales, who ridicules all complementary and alternative medicine and research under these fields as, quote, the work of lunatic charlatans. I repeat, to all of the different institutions, to all the qualified scientists, researchers, to all of the peer-reviewed journals, to the National Academy of Sciences, quote, the work of lunatic charlatans, deeming it unworthy of accurate or balanced inclusion in Wikipedia. The skeptics that zealously guard the gates of Wikipedia's medical entries faithfully parrot the words of their spiritual leader, denigrating all practitioners of complementary medicine and alternative medicine as quacks. Are we to assign the same credibility to Susan Jurbich, a retired portrait photographer who leads the guerrilla skepticism on Wikipedia's initiative, teaching skeptics how to strengthen their already formidable foothold in the encyclopedia, as we do to the hundreds of thousands of articles written by researchers from prestigious institutions that argue there are effective, proven ways to heal people using complementary medicine? Few among the skeptics' number have experienced the medical field at all. Their current white-coated superstar, Dr. David Gorski, appears to brim with barely suppressed disdain for alternative medicine, despite lacking clinical experience or board certification outside of his limited field of surgical oncology. Where has he published the clinical studies he has conducted proving these treatments are ineffective? Surely he would not be so scientifically irresponsible as to condemn a healing modality without testing it. It is time for the world to re-examine the lack of objectivity, honesty, and fairness shown by those correcting and operating outside the rigid bounds of orthodox medicine who have made major progress and discoveries in healing patients. The pioneers expanding the horizons of medical treatment should be the ones trusted with our communal medical knowledge, not Wales, Gorski, or the other skeptics. They are only capable of tearing down the contributions of others. When we hear Gorski and other skeptics unconditionally condemn, with no first-hand experience, any and all alternative therapies as, quote, unproven treatments, then condemn any research into these therapies that proves their efficacy, their palpable fear and loathing of an entire field can be reviewed as reaching the point of self-parody. Is one person's opinion supposed to scare the public away from pursuing these modalities? It is our opinion that this McCarthyism is now, and it supersedes good medicine on Wikipedia. Gorski recently attempted to prove that certain concerns over the death caused by orthodox treatments is excessive, and that modern medicine's downsides are not nearly as great as we've been led to believe. We take this matter very seriously and recently revisited our multi-year investigation into the problem. Iatrogenesis kills a truly staggering number of Americans each year, 987,507, according to our most recent calculations, which use statistics from the CDC and other government agencies, along with top-ranked medical journals like the Journal of the American Medical Association, the British Medical Journal, among others. That's significantly more than the number of people who died of heart disease, which killed 635,260 in 2016, or cancer, which ended 598,038 lives that same year. Now, while these diseases are also public health issues and crisis, indeed, the nation is unhealthier than it has ever been, with record rates of obesity and general metabolic ill health. Iatrogenesis has largely escaped public notice. There is no patentable drug to treat medically induced death. And without a profit motive, there is no incentive to find a cure. And while we've only have been too happy to commend and recommend any procedure proven to save lives and improve quality of life without dangerous side effects, and while there are plenty of such treatments available to patients, there are far too many that aren't. And there's still no industry-wide effort being made to fix the dark side of medicine. Maverick voices within the medical community have been demanding reform for years to address the phenomena of iatrogenic, meaning death by medicine, but to no avail. Dr. Martin Makary wrote to the head of the Center for Disease Control in 2016 and pled for a death certificate code for medical error, pointing out that the absence of such a code makes accurate measurements of iatrogenesis extremely difficult, as well as placing a roadblock in the way of funding solutions to the problem. The issue has been debated within the medical community ever since the Institute of Medicine's landmark study, quote, "To Err is Human," published in 1999, found 98,000 deaths every year were attributable to iatrogenesis. Subsequently, Dr. Makary in 2016 and patient safety advocate Dr. John T. James estimated that 251,454 to 440,000 deaths, respectively, among hospital patients alone, meaning just dying in hospitals. We are not including people who took a medication, had a medical procedure, went home, and because of that, died at home. There's no measurement for that at all. And then they had other numbers. Our own 2009 work, Death by Medicine, estimated 797,926 inpatient and outpatient deaths annually. And when we revisited those numbers just in the last few months, we were shocked to find they'd risen even higher to approximately 987,570 Americans dying each year. Preventable deaths. You're talking about nearly a million preventable deaths per year. The need for medical reform has never been more obvious, and we've written extensively about how this could be accomplished. Dr. Gorski, however, categorically dismisses the idea that iatrogenesis is the third leading cause of death, as Dr. Makary and Dr. James allege. Never mind the first. Gorski scorns these respected doctors without addressing their arguments and fails to bring sufficient evidence to bear to back up his own argument, which relies heavily upon his own medical authority. First, Gorski points out that there are only 2.7 million deaths in the United States each year, and that if Makary's figures are correct, it would mean between 9 and 16% of all Americans dying were caused by medical error. This is absurd, Gorski says, without explaining, well, how or why is it absurd, given the multiplicity of ways in which medical error can cause a person's death and the interactions of other factors and diseases and drugs. A 16% figure is extremely plausible. Even our own figure of 987,507 deaths, which would equate to 36% of all U.S. deaths annually, is not outside the realm of possibility, considering how many people receive medical treatment in the weeks and months preceding death or expire in hospitals, given how few medical errors are reported, about 1 in 10. That's a big factor. So 90% of medical errors are never reported, or deaths from those errors. So it's entirely possible that our numbers are too low. Gorski does not address the reporting gap, such as well-known problem in medical practice that an entire body sprung up to address it following the reporting gap and the passage of the Affordable Care Act. We believe this is because it doesn't fit his argument. Instead, he maligns the global trigger tool which Makary used to calculate his error rate, claiming it is, quote, arguably way too sensitive, end quote, without explaining exactly why he feels this way. The use of the weasel word arguably is telling, suggesting he may lack the facts to back up his argument, and such, quote, weasel words abound in his deconstruction of Makary's 2016 paper. Makary, Gorski writes, quote, conflated unavoidable complications with medical errors, end quote, even though unavoidable is in the eye of the beholder, given that many safety practices now considered routine were unheard of when the Institute of Medicine study was first brought about patient safety in the mainstream media in 1999. Medication reconciliation, for example, in which a doctor examines a patient's chart to determine whether a drug the patient is taking will react poorly with the drug he is about to prescribe, was hardly discussed in 1999. Gorski does not specify which sort of unavoidable complications, end quote, he means. It's difficult to address the argument beyond that, which is likely his point. Unavoidable complications are unavoidable. A tautology immune to logic and reasoning. More weasel words follow. Markey, quote, Makary, didn't consider very well whether the deaths were potentially preventable, end quote. This hardly bears addressing what is, quote, very well. How well would satisfy Gorski? The studies also, quote, extrapolated from smaller numbers, end quote, most likely because with no corresponding CDC code, there is no easy way to measure medical error on a nationwide scale, which is part of what Makary points out, and, quote, used administrative databases which are primarily designed for insurance billing and thus not very good for other prospects, end quote. Once again, he fails to explain his statement, perhaps assuming that a key reader will take his word for it. Quote, not very good, end quote, is another weasel word comparable to what? Betraying a weakness in his argument? That is only half of our article. I'll go just to the conclusions, which I think are important, and that is, faced with the conservative, well-documented, and meticulously researched statistics put forward by Drs. Martin Feldman and myself and Dr. John T. James, Gorski clings to the one contradictory study he can find, in our opinion, stubbornly misinterpreting and exaggerating its results to support his view that iatrogenesis is a minor issue undeserving of further attention. He claims that, quote, grossly exaggerating the scope of the problem does no one, quote, other than quacks, end quote, any favors. But fails to explain how a quack would benefit from the medical community taking steps to address the high rate of error that currently slips by without being reported. Indeed, and this is important, properly addressing the iatrogenesis issues would benefit orthodox medicine and patients, most of all, as it would go a long way towards restoring America's trust in the medical profession. A 2009 study found 1 in 3 patients had experienced a medical error in the last 2 years alone. As a medical professional, Gorski should be concerned above all with the health of his patients, with healing them by any means necessary, even those considered, quote, implausible, according to his medical school textbooks. In our opinion, he gives the impression he is primarily concerned with his reputation and that his profession, so much so that he'd rather tear down alternative healing methods proven to help patients than admit they may be effective. Gorski's willingness to devote an entire blog post to minimizing the extent of iatrogenic harms, defending the failures of his fellow doctors, instead of acknowledging that American medicine is in need of serious reform. That speaks volumes. And just as a postscript, what if you or your family member had been injured by an improperly performed medical procedure? What if you or a family member had died because of the medical treatment, receiving excessive radiation? One of my very close friends, Jerry Krupman, received cancer surgery, which was successful, removing all the cancer, but then they gave him round after round of radiation, quote, to prevent future cancer, they said, and that radiation was so abundant in his body that he had no appetite, he lost his strength, he ended up dying of acute malnutrition. What does it say when we have nearly a million people dying at the hands of medicine each year? It is not to challenge their intent. I believe all are well-intentioned. They want to help their patients, but what if the tools they're using are not the tools they should be using? What if the medications are not the right medications? What if there's no emphasis upon prevention? What if the diet and lifestyle and exercise and meditation and prayer and other known and proven complementary approaches to health to keep a person well or help them if they're sick, what if none of that is discussed with the patient because it's considered unscientific, but the scientific literature is replete with hundreds of thousands of studies supporting alternative approaches from vitamins and minerals to meditation and exercise to de-stressing and cleaning up your environment to a healthy plant-based diet? These are not anecdotals. These are not without scientific support. The entire body of scientific medicine is replete with the best institutions publishing outstanding studies, appearing in the National Academy of Library and before the National Academy of Sciences and all the major journals. So on the one hand, we have this almost unbelievable cognitive disconnect. American science, and the rest of the world as well, but I'm only referring to American science, has proven beyond a shadow of a doubt that these modalities deserve respect. You can do additional testing if you want, but they work. At what point in testing vitamin C after you have 40,000 tests do you say we have enough? At what point is it no longer about testing to see how much vitamin C a person needs? There are thousands of studies on that, but because it's your livelihood, because you have reoccurring grants, and because you can stay in your position receiving money to your institution, whether it's university or college or private research laboratory, because you manage to position yourself at the feeding trough of public funding. So the science is no longer necessary. It's there. Every major university, every major journal has thousands of these reports and studies. And on the other side, we have a group of people, many of whom have no background in science, no medical degrees, no board certifications, and have never written anything concerning the human body, have never counseled anyone, are not certified to counsel anyone, and yet they who could be hanging pictures or taking photographs or working on a car engine, suddenly they become the world's greatest experts, more so than all of these institutions, all the cumulative experience of all the hundreds of millions of patients who benefited. What kind of mindset allows that lack of reason, objectivity? And yet that is what Jimmy Wales, and that is what the skeptics at Wikipedia have done. Now, take a look at all the people, some of the finest minds on the planet, like Rupert Sheldrake. Think of the people who've been victimized, vilified, and destroyed to the degree that the public no longer wants anything to do with them, won't even look into the area. And this passes for objectivity? Not in my world it doesn't. And so we'll continue. We posted this full article, and we're sending a copy of this article to every member of Jimmy Wales and Wikipedia's legal team. That should get their attention. And also to the people involved, all the skeptics. That will definitely get their attention because we have articles coming up on each and then every one of their skeptics. And by the way, just for those of you who have been slandered and libeled, your whole profession, your whole career, all the other people in your field, like all alternative doctors, Well, very shortly, you may find out the actual identities of those people doing all this editing and attacking using anonymous names. Well, that's in the past. More to come. Back in a moment with my guests. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. We're going to Pittsburgh right now, where Professor Dan Kovalik is standing by. I gave you his bio earlier in the program. He is a human rights and labor justice attorney. He's a peace activist, and he's an adjunct professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and he specializes in Latin American problems. I gave you some of his lawsuits. He's a graduate of Columbia University Law School, and he contributes to Counterpunch, Telesure, Huffington Post, and he's published books on scapegoating of Russia and U.S. efforts to overthrow the Iranian government. His most recent book is The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much.
Earlier in America's history, it was federal intelligence agencies, notably the CIA, that most interfered in other nations' domestic policies and elections. The late William Blum, who I interviewed on this program several times, who has been one of the leading voices, said that there have been 81 different regime changes the United States has conducted during the past 70-odd years. Now it is the State Department, I'm sure in consort with the CIA, that plays a leading role in foreign policy interference. And during the Obama administration, it was largely Hillary Clinton orchestrating regime changes in Honduras, Ukraine, and Libya. And then there is also the National Endowment for Democracy that has funded people such as Ronald Reagan. So please speak about the institutional infrastructure that has emerged that has taken on the mission or mantle to interfere in other nations' affairs and elections and even regime changes to assure foreign governments give allegiance to the Washington consensus. The forum is yours.
Yes. Thank you very much, Gary. So first of all, I think the main arm of regime change since the 80s, founded by Ronald Reagan, is the National Endowment for Democracy, which spends millions of dollars to support various opposition groups throughout the world with the explicit aim of regime change. To give just one example, there was this, insurrection over the summer in Nicaragua, which became very violent. And that began in mid-April of last year. In May, a magazine run by one of the arms of the National Endowment for Democracy bragged about laying the groundwork for that insurrection. The NED had given about $4 million over a four-year period to various opposition groups in Nicaragua aimed at overthrowing the government of Daniel Ortega. And then they admitted that this helped lay the groundwork for the violence that took place over the summer. But they do this time and again. The NED was very instrumental in the coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002. People may not even remember that. But, you know, Hugo Chavez was kidnapped. He was the duly elected president of Venezuela. He was kidnapped by a rogue sector of the military, taken away to an island, and he was finally brought back because the poor of Venezuela came to the White House there, it's called Miraflores there, and demanded his return. And again, the NED was very instrumental in setting up that coup d'etat. And we see this time and again. You mentioned Honduras. In Honduras, certainly the NED had a role there, but in Honduras, the bigger role, as you mentioned, was Hillary Clinton, who in her book, Hard Choices, at least in the hardcover version, the initial version, admitted that she helped solidify the coup in Honduras. Now, she took out that admission in the paperback version because people, not surprisingly, reacted very negatively to that admission. But in addition to Hillary, the Army, the School of the Americas, the U.S. Army School of the Americas was very critical in that coup, which took place in 2009. And what happened is two generals who were trained at the Army School of the Americas, one of them at least was had two different trainings there. They kidnapped the president, Manuel Zelaya, in the middle of the night, took him out of his house, still in his pajamas, and they flew him out of the country. And again, the U.S., particularly Hillary Clinton, worked to make sure that elections then were held without Zelaya returning. And it's very interesting, by the way, that I note the date. It took this a while to dawn on me, but it was 2009. This was not long after Daniel Ortega was reelected president of Nicaragua after about an 18-year, 17-year hiatus. And I think these two things are linked. I think that the U.S., you know, has a plan for Latin America. They want to roll back the so-called pink tide, the progressive tide that Hugo Chavez helped usher in 1999. And so country after country, they've interfered in to try to roll that back. And, of course, now we are at real crossroads with Venezuela, where military intervention by the U.S. is a very real possibility.
I'd like to touch a little more on Honduras, because Obama and Clinton's overthrow of the democratically elected government received little attention, and most of the migrants in the caravans are from Honduras, who have been completely uprooted since the U.S. stage coup. It was among the three most violent nations in the world, and Obama and Clinton do not receive the blame they deserve for devastating Honduras, nor is there any strong outcries from other nations. And now U.S. meddling in Nicaragua and Venezuela can likely lead to similar horrible conditions of runaway human rights abuse and violence in these countries. So please lay out the story behind the Obama administration's ousting. You mentioned Zelaya, but what threats did Zelaya pose to the United States that you didn't mention?
Yes, well, it's a very good question. So Manuel Zelaya, first of all, was an interesting fellow. He came out of the business community in Honduras. He himself was a businessman, and he was elected on a fairly conservative platform. But as time went on in his presidency, he became very aware of the problems of poverty in his country and inequality. And he began fairly modest but progressive changes that included a 60% rise in the minimum wage. And he began social reforms in that country to try to do something to alleviate poverty. The other thing that he made it clear is he was thinking about kicking out the U.S. military base there. And the U.S. has a giant military base. In fact, Honduras has been called a, you know, stationary aircraft carrier of the United States because of this base. So because of his threats to shut down the base, because of the rise in minimum wage that he led, which affected U.S. companies like Chiquita Banana. Of course, Honduras was one of the original so-called banana republics because of Chiquita, formerly United Fruit. This very much worried the United States. And as I said, generals who were trained by the United States, carried out a coup against Zelaya. And he was never returned to power. He ended up having to live in Nicaragua for a bit. Nicaragua took him in after he was flown out of the country. And yes, Honduras has never been the same. Since Zelaya was ousted, there has been numerous murders of journalists, of human rights leaders, of land rights activists, of indigenous leaders, of gay activists. And again, as you mentioned, there's been virtually no media coverage of this. You know, it's very interesting how the media you know, the propaganda system works, when the U.S. has its sight on a country for regime change like Venezuela right now, we hear about it every day, and we hear a very one-sided version of what's happening there, right? But meanwhile, we don't hear about the much worse humanitarian situation in Honduras, or even the much worse humanitarian situation in Colombia, South America, which is right next door to Venezuela, which has had over 150 social leaders killed, mostly by state forces, in the last year, 150. Meanwhile, Colombia also has the largest internally displaced population on Earth. On Earth, even more than Syria, at over 7 million internally displaced people. And yet we don't hear about that humanitarian crisis. That is not of concern because Colombia, of course, is the closest ally the U.S. has in South America. And so the crimes of Colombia are ignored, if not covered up. And instead, we have this obsessive coverage of Venezuela to try to prime the population for regime change there.
Doesn't it just roil your blood when you hear Rachel Maddow or others on CNN and all the other networks talk about Venezuela as if somehow it's needed that there's regime change when the regime that was there, had they not been undermined, would have continued Hugo Chavez's People's Revolution? There seems to be a domino effect, a power exchange in Latin America right now. After Honduras, now it's Nicaragua and Venezuela. There's also renewed stirrings in Haiti and Dominican Republic, and other countries are tipping to right-wing conservative regimes. You mentioned Colombia, but also Brazil and Argentina have been puppets in the United States' spheres for decades now. Our final question then should be, look at Haiti. Haitians are in the street revolting. They can't afford food. They're back to what they had under the Clinton-inspired coup. And why aren't the Clintons held responsible for contributing to the destabilization? First, because of he allowing imports of cheap rice and other products that undermine the natural economy there. And also the $13 billion that was earned for the hurricane survivors, that didn't go to them. In fact, even the Red Cross received $1 billion and only spent, I think it was enough money to buy or build six little homes and kept all the rest as administrative fees. But the Clintons were responsible for a far greater amount of money being raised, and no one knows where the money went. Your thoughts?
Yes, well, I think the situation with Haiti is one of the more despicable episodes in U.S. intervention. In fact, as Noam Chomsky points out, it's been intervened in by the U.S. more than any other country, and therefore, not surprisingly, it's the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. As you mentioned, Bill Clinton would later apologize for his food policies, which he himself admitted undermined the ability of Haitians to feed themselves. The U.S. has been involved in numerous coups in Haiti. Most recently, the most brazen one was in 2004 when the U.S., Canada, and France forced the president, the democratically elected president, Father Jean-Bertrand Aristide, to board a plane, and he was taken out of the country to Central Africa in a very overt form of coup d'etat. And since that time, you've had a series of very pro-U.S. Leaders there who have ignored the plight of the poor. Now the poor are rising up in Haiti, as you say, and they're getting clobbered by the military of Haiti and by the police. And yet again, you hear barely a whisper of this in the press.
I just think it's disturbing that we allow people to commit crimes against humanity like in Libya, the most stable, most prosperous, best educated, best healthcare system, no debt. And yet, of the 54 nations in Africa, it was the Paris that was the best. Gaddafi was the most loved leader in Africa. And Hillary Clinton took him out. What does that say about all the people surrounding her in Washington, in the Washington consensus?
Yeah, well, it says a lot. And as you say, Hillary Clinton was a prime mover in the NATO invasion against Gaddafi. which, as you say, took the most prosperous country in Africa, and after the invasion, it's now the least prosperous country. Now slaves are being sold on the streets of Libya, an incredible thing. And it was Hillary Clinton's lies, and they were lies, about Gaddafi and about Libya, which helped pave the way for that regime change. And it says a lot. I mean, there, what it says is there is a bipartisan agreement on the right of the U.S. to intervene in countries at will, to take out popular governments and replace them with governments that will do the bidding of the United States. And the Clintons have been as bad on those issues as any Republican. And yet, as you know, they seem to get a pass. People,
yeah, they do up to this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, liberals are the worst. Liberals
are the worst.
Yep, you are right. They no values. Anything that's in identity politics, they get away with, and they shouldn't. They shouldn't be given that opportunity. Dan, thank you very much. I want to have you back for a full hour in the Progressive Commentary Hour to talk in greater depth about this. And if you'd like to come back about American interventionism in the broader perspective, not just in Latin and Central America, but also around Europe and the Middle East, let Richard Gale know, and we'll have you back on, all right?
I would love to do that. Thank you so much.
All the best to you. Professor Dan Kovalik, C-O-V-A-L-I-K, and he is a labor justice attorney, human rights attorney, peace activist, and he's gone after a lot of big guys. He also won Project Censored Award. He's on the side of the people. His latest book is The Plot to Control the World, How the U.S. Spent Billions to Change the Outcome of Elections Around the World. Have a nice day, everyone. See you tomorrow.